Sivasanamami Supatipano Bhagavato Savakasango Ujjupatipano Bhagavato Savakasango Yaya Patipano Bhagavato Savakasango Samichi Patipano Bhagavato Savakasango Yaditang Chatari Purisayugani Ata Purisapugala Esa Bhagavato Savakasango Ahuneyo Ahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutarang Punyaketa Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami.
This is what should be done. I, one who is still in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. Conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later improve, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any stage. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a harmless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world.
exactly. The three D's. The mountain. Okay. Well, actually, just was reminded by Venerable Posada to do preparation for like a tinner ceremony on Sunday. There are some piles of weeds and old twigs, and we're going to be burning them tomorrow at 5 p.m. They're just over that way. So, whatever questions aren't answered this evening.
Ho, ho, ho. Yeah, yeah. It's not going to be that much. It's at 5 p.m, so just when. If you. Cooting early, cottage number 10, and stuff like that, maybe.
And if there is some mistake and the fires really start going and the fire comes up to your cottages, what should you do? Get into jhanas. And you've got nothing to worry about.
Hee hee hee.
Okay, here we go. How can I be more comfortable with being alone in the forest or to be by myself without feeling sad for loneliness? How can I feel safe and happy in being alone? You're not alone. You're with yourself. Your best friend. Oh, sometimes, you know, when you're alone, you want to be with people. And when you're with people, oh, you want to be alone. So, so sometimes, two bad bricks in the wall, when you're by yourself, oh, you're missing so many difficulties and problems. So I think of the best side of it. Wait, I'm by myself, yay. And when you're with people, yay, I can do some service for people. So either way. But there are times when you're with people and you want to be alone. So that's why you can develop those meditations. You just imagine yourself in a bubble. Because I have to be in situations sometimes, lots and lots of people. And even the only place you can meditate is noisy places, in the middle of town, or next to a party where they're playing karaoke, or I remember once in Suvarnabhumi Airport, and they were waiting for another arrival for this conference. And they were coming in an hour's time, and they said, would you mind just waiting? No problem. So, just put my hands together, and I just imagined a bubble. And in the bubble, it's like my cave. And I went inside my cave and so, yeah, I didn't get into the jhana, but I could hear people, but they were way away, like they were a long distance from me. And that meant that just you had lots of peace. So I couldn't go too deep because otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be able to get me out again. And I didn't know when the other person was going to arrive. So that's how you do these things. Just imagine a bubble. But it is true that you're always with somebody, your best friend. And what was that? No, I won't tell the story because I've gone all night. A monk said the Christian concept of original sin is the same as karma. I warned him not to conflate the two terms, but he insisted he was right. Is that concept of original same as karma? No, original sin was done by a woman, wasn't it? That's what they say. Anyway, it's Eve's fault. But karma is not gender specific. Karma is the modern world. Everybody makes good karma. Everybody makes bad karma. Was that right? I think that's original sin. That's what it was. They blame poor old Eve. For me, oh, what was it? Dr. Kesavi Dhammananda once said. He said, the Garden of Eden, I think this was a story, please correct me if I'm wrong, because this is in the Christian Bible. in the Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve, and then they had a snake. And the snake convinced Eve to eat the apple. That was right, wasn't it? Okay, one of those anyway. But anyway. Okay, Eve convinced Adam to eat the apple. But, he said, if the Garden of Eden was, say, in China or Vietnam, then they would eat the snake.
Look at the end of the problem. Those monks have a weird sense of humour. Well done. So totally different than that original sin. It's no original. And it's not sin. A sin is an offence against the law of God. That's what a sin means. And so this is not the law of God, this is the law of kindness, of common sense, not harming or hurting anybody. Not sort of a God-made law. So, it's the idea of karma. What are you doing that for? Why are you doing that? Is it really helpful? Is it hurting? And even with karma, the main part of karma is intention. Why are you doing it? And if you're doing it to make peace, be kind, be gentle, it's right intention, right motivation. Of course, it can never be bad karma. You're coming from kindness, not from hurt and harm. There's lots and lots of difference. As a monk said that, it must have been a Christian monk. Anyway, but that makes absolutely no sense to me. Jhanas are an altered state. Not altered. They're revered. That's why I think you said an altar state. Could you? And I'm trying my best. Could you please talk about how they lead to altered traits that are closest to enlightenment? The whole idea of altering things. You think if you alter it, it makes it better. It doesn't. You accept it. Embrace it. And learn how to be peaceful. And when you're not changing things, when you're still, then they change and become very deep. That's why sometimes some people, I don't know why you came here, but now you're here, you listen to things maybe you didn't expect to hear. But sometimes people learn meditation because they think they need to change their attitude. They need to alter the way they think, the way they do stuff. And you find if you try and alter it, it just gets even worse sometimes. So instead of changing yourself, we understand ourselves. This is the difference between curing and caring. That doctor who was 36 years I've been here in West Australia, and seen many, many people grow up as little kids. If you ever go to Bodhi Nyana Monastery for lunch, you see all these kids running around. And yeah, they run around. You never tell them off. You're naughty, just shut up. You've got to be in a temple. Don't be disrespectful. No, let them run around. Let them have fun and scream and giggle and play hide and seek. And then, because what happens is they get familiar with the temple, and they get to know the monks and nuns, they're their friends. And as they grow through school and high school and university, they've got this wonderful resource of like monks and nuns they can trust, their parents trust. And they're just with them throughout the whole of their life, and then they get married, and we give them advice about getting married. So the first advice we gave them when they're getting married is don't. No, that's only a joke. No, and then with their kids and stuff, and we give them, because they know us and they trust us and we know them, it makes life very easy to help and serve.
But what happens sometimes is that they get into really difficulties. And this one guy, seen him, I knew his parents, and they were very good supporters. I think one of them was the one who organized that cake store. You know, when I first came here, I told about yesterday, where I did sleep at night because the smell of delicious cakes, freshly baked, torture. Anyway, that there we were. Their son, doing well, became a doctor. And that was when he came to see me, one Saturday morning. And he said, I've got to change my career, find another job. He said, I can't do this doctoring anymore. And that was all that effort and time he spent learning and studying and graduating. And now he was a doctor, and what went wrong? And that's when he told me that that morning, one of his patients had died unexpectedly. And it was a tragedy. What had happened, it was a young woman, 23, 24, and he didn't know, it was wrong, what was wrong. It was supposed to be a small thing, and then, the warnings came, and he tried to save her, but then she passed away. It wasn't his fault, but he had to be the one who went to see her husband. A young couple, just totally devoted to one another, in just the first blossomings of love. And he had to tell this man that the woman he committed to and was dreaming of spending the rest of his life with is no more. And it was unexpected. But even worse, they had two young children. And this man had to explain to the kids, "Where's Mummy? She's dead." And if that wasn't hard enough, that the father had to figure out how he's going to live, looking after these two little kids without their mum. And he said it was just so painful, like a sensitive, I can't explain it, I try my best to bring out those emotions, but imagine what it must have been like. That husband, it was just pain upon pain, it was like twisting the knife in him. And this doctor always felt he was responsible. Of course, he wasn't responsible at all. It was just, these things happen in life. It wasn't his fault. He couldn't have done any better. But still, he blamed himself. And he thought, with all my career as a doctor in front of me, that's going to happen again. And I just can't do that anymore. I can't just endure inflicting such pain on another like that. And that's when, because he trusted me, he wanted to find my advice, and that's where I started off, this curing, not caring. Sorry, the other way around, caring, not curing. So, I said, look, if you think that the main job of your career as a doctor is to cure people, you're going to fail many times. And you are going to go through this. You're not going to be able to cure people of the diseases, and it's a tragedy sometimes. Really good people, prime of life, well loved and cared for, and something goes wrong, you can't cure that disease. And you will feel a failure many times. But, I said, you'll never need to feel a failure if your primary concern is to care for people. Care for the patients and their families who you're dealing with. You never need to fail if you care for people. And that changes the whole of that illness, sickness, dying or recovery. Even if the person died, they know they were cared for with the greatest compassion. The family were cared for and loved. It's not about curing, it's about caring. If you make caring the priority, you never need to fail. And I told him, if you make caring more important than curing, you will find that less people die under your sort of care. Sometimes the interventions which we have to people when they're very sick, sometimes the last thing we want to do is to allow them to die. Curing them at all costs, rather than caring for them at all costs. And when you're cared for, that's huge therapy. And of course that's what he's done all his life, and he said, yeah, some people should have died, but they didn't die because I cared for them, rather than curing them. So that is so important. In your relationship, your partner in life, are you trying to cure them? It was one of those retreats, I think it was over in Singapore once, and I think I asked and said, oh, it's really nice to see you here, why did you come here? She said, I didn't want to come. Well, why are you here? My wife sent me. She said, you'll make me a better husband. And I said, that's really wrong. You don't send someone to a monastery or even to a psychologist to cure them. You care for them. Don't try and cure them, care for them. And in any relationship, if you care for your partner, instead of trying to cure them, then the relationship blossoms. How many of you have had a partner and they're always trying to cure you of your bad habits? I've had Ajahn Brahmani trying to cure me of my bad jokes. It doesn't work. Wasting time. No, you care for one another. And then you care and you're such kind. Oh, okay, I won't tell that joke tonight, Ajahn Brahmani. Because you appreciate that. And so you find out caring is far more effective than curing. But it does affect the cure in the end. So that's one of the reasons why that trying to send somebody here to cure them of their difficulties or their defilements. Try and care for your defilements. See how that changes. Don't try and cure your depression. Care for it. It's radical, but my goodness, it does work. Okay, so an altered state. We're not altered. We care for our mind and it gets into charge. Don't cure it and change it. Okay. And could you please talk about your best examples of people who have taken up Buddhist practice and changed their traits positively? Oh, there's so many. It's uncountable. Let's see. Who can we say? Changed their traits positively. Oh, there's that person up the road. Taken up Buddhist practice and changed their traits positively. Who use? Oh, no, this is a good example. Some of the prisoners who used to be in jail and up the road. And there was this couple of prisoners there. I would teach them meditation every week. And then one day, the one I remember was called Nick. And of course, Nick is not my driver who's sitting over the back over there. Not that Nick. Another Nick. And Nick told me, when I went there to teach meditation, I got there 5 minutes early, which was good because he grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me to the schoolroom where they had a display of cards written by school children. This was a while ago now, I don't mind saying it, in Jarrahdale Primary School. Because what had happened was the primary school in Western Australia up to 11 or 12 years of age, I think grade 6 or 7, I think they changed it recently, but I think grade 6 or 7, and there were drugs in even primary school. I was shocked about this, but it's a fact of the matter. And So the principal wanted to do something to help the children she was responsible for, so they never took drugs, whether at class, at school, nor did they, would they take drugs when they moved into the high school. And so what sort of program could she present to children to convince them to stay away from drugs? So, she could get a psychologist in from the education department. She could get the police in. But she thought outside the box, and she said, who are the experts on drugs? The people who've been using them. Who know how much pain and difficulty that those drugs inflict on the users, the sellers, and also on society. Those who are in jail, experiencing that suffering directly. So she managed to contact the superintendent of the prison at Carnet, just up the road, and arrange for two prisoners to spend the day in the primary school, talking to each class, not from theory, not as a doctor or a psychologist, but as someone who is really suffering right at this moment from the effect of drugs and being incarcerated in prison. And so these prisoners went there for the whole day and talked to these kids. And the next day in like art class, remember when you were maybe a kid, you do little drawings and say thank you to Nick for coming to our school to actually to teach us not to take drugs. And that really connected with the children. And so I had all these cards on the wall there. Nick, thank you so much for coming. We will never take drugs. Once you explain what it does to you and what it's done and what it happens, never will we do this. Nick, may you get out of jail soon. When you get out of jail, please come and see us again. All the best, Carol. All the best, Tony. All the best, John. And all these kids had shown their appreciation. And Nick, he was weeping. His tears were flooding the floor. You can imagine what he'd done. When you do sort of a crime like that, you're put in jail. And you're stuck in the jail there feeling terrible about yourself. And just you do reflect upon all the harm and the hurt you've done to you, your family, the people who trusted you, and the people who actually bought the drugs which you sold to them. Now he could do something positive, something to pay back some of his debts. And the opportunity to do that, and the goodness he'd actually reached to those kids, and stopped many of them from ever taking drugs. And that's why he's weeping and weeping and weeping. And a few years later, I was in Perth Airport, just waiting to pick up some guest, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder. And I looked around, do you remember me? Hey, it's Nick. You've been released. Yeah, and he was in a really sharp suit. And he said, yeah, look, I'm doing well now. And he said, I'm still meditating every day. He said, Brahm, every day I'm still meditating. And it's really proud of that. But what was really I was proud of was that principal in that primary school who had the guts, the nerve, to invite the experts to teach her children. If some of the papers had found out, principal lets drug addicts into primary school, and many of the parents would be up in arms protesting. But she knew who could teach the kids the best. And how it just helped Nick, it was win-win all the way. So, that certainly changed Nick. You mentioned when a person went into jhana and coming out, it's a blissful experience. Could you please explain, elaborate it? How long does the bliss last? Exactly 6 hours, 20 minutes and 30 seconds. Of course you don't know how long the bliss lasts. Deeper you get, the bliss lasts a long time. still you're really high for a long time. And of course, you know, you try and maintain it because of the blissful state, but then how long does it last? Who knows? It depends on just what happens afterwards and just, you know, how soon that you get sort of have to do stuff. But it's a long time. Would it change a person from bad to good? E.g. bad temper to good? Of course it does, because you're so soft, you can't have a bad temper while you're there. And sometimes it gives you the wisdom, the insight to understand, you know, why do we get sort of bad at people? Well, can't we sort of let people make mistakes and forgive people? We're not trying to cure people. Anger tries to cure people. Loving kindness just cares for people. And you also mentioned after coming back, five senses come back. Does it mean he, she will then become who she was before? She was a no one before. She's a nobody afterwards. That's why they have this beautiful t-shirt, one of those with a wonderful saying. And I'm sure many of you have heard the first line. Nobody is perfect. Oh, don't rush it. Come on. Take it away. So, okay. Nobody is perfect. What's the second line? I am a nobody. Third line, therefore I am perfect. Nobody is perfect. I'm a nobody, therefore I'm perfect. That's logic. Okay. So, learning how to be a no one. Any chances we can see in a person? Huh? Changes you see in a person. Oh, of course you do. What was it? Just in ordinary meditation. I already mentioned that this is another good one. This is years ago, there was a gentleman lived in Perth. He was a Buddhist. His wife was, well, she didn't mind him being a Buddhist, but she wasn't really into it. And he always wanted to go on a retreat, a meditation retreat, but weekend retreat was all the time he could get. And so he asked his wife, weekend retreat, can I go? And she said, no, it's too busy on the weekend. We've got the kids to look after, you've got to do the shopping, we've got to do the washing and all the stuff for the week. No, it's too busy, you can't, don't be selfish. And so he said, okay. And so the next time there was a retreat, he asked again. And oh, mother's coming over, you've got to clean out the garage, you've got to take the car for a service, it's too busy, no, you can't go. And that happened all the time, not all the time, but several times. He wanted to go on a retreat, but you know, there's too many things on the weekend. When both people are working, you've got kids, the weekend is where you catch up on the housework. And then there was a retreat on, you know what happened? He said, can I go on a retreat? And she got so frustrated with him. She said, okay, you go on your stupid retreat. You leave me with the housework, with the kids, with the mother coming and everything else. And he took that as a yes. So off he went on his retreat. And this was how he told it to me. He said, when he came home after a weekend retreat, he was such a beautiful husband. Calm, sensitive, and no, not arguing, and willing to help even more than before. He was recharged. And she was surprised and impressed. So much so that when he turned up for the very next retreat, he said, what happened? Your wife, you know, let you come. She said, not only she let me come, she gave me the money and sent me away to go. She realized the effect it has on me. And so that's a wonderful thing. So if any of you got any husbands, you know, who's a bit sort of grumpy or difficult or, send them to the retreat for the weekend. Or even better than that, you've got a boss at work who's just really a pain in the neck. It's because they're stressed out. So get a collection together in the office to send your boss to Jhana Grove for the next 9-day retreat. And when he comes back, he'll be just this beautiful boss. He's just opening the door of your heart to all the people who work for him. and just being so calm and peaceful, just coming out of the jhanas, and he's got no ill will at all, his generosity is so good. You say, boss, I need a raise. No worries at all. How much more money do you need? His kindness and generosity. No, no, no.
I don't think I live in the real world, do you?
But it does actually work there to improve. Is Nibbana the unconditioned aspect of consciousness? No, it's the end of consciousness. If samsara is conditioned, sankata, Nibbana is unconditioned. No, it's not unconditioned, it's beyond conditions. How does a conditioned Eightfold Path lead to Nibbana? It's not conditioned Eightfold Path, it's just things which happen and it leads to cessation, it's turning itself off. It's like what Nagarjuna says in the Majjhima Nikaya that samsara is Nibbana. No, that's not what he says at all. Fake news. It just thinks, why are people so afraid of things ending? People like things continuing on forever and ever and ever. Instead of things ending, your consciousness finishing. Done. Hey, no more conscious awareness ever again. Would that be nice? Scary, isn't it? But, why not? Okay, Bhante, could you share with us what the late Ajahn Tate taught you? Two things which he taught me that he was, of all the monks I've ever visited, he was the one who looked like an arahat. You know, sometimes you don't know who's enlightened and who's not. Because sometimes, you know, there's people are just, they've got their idiosyncrasies. And sometimes these arahats, you don't know what they're up to. But this one, he looked, he smelt, everything was just a very peaceful, very good, very kind, simple monk. He was the one who, when I first arrived in Thailand, he was in Sirirat Hospital, dying of cancer. Looked after by His Majesty the King of Thailand. So got the excellent, the best treatment. And so when the doctors said, your cancer is terminal, there's nothing more we can do. He said, well, if that's the case, I'd rather die in my monastery than die over in the hospital in Bangkok. So they sent him up to the monastery. And about, he did die there about 25 years later. That is amazing, just the beautiful monk. And one of the things which happened there, that I just wanted to go and see him. I had some questions. And as I was actually waiting to go into the room to speak to him, there was a rich Malaysian woman who was talking to him. And she said to him, well, you know, I got into this deep state of meditation. It was very peaceful. And she says, well, my mind was totally blank. That was fourth jhana, wasn't it? And Ajahn Tate said, no, that's not fourth jhana. He said, but you know, it was no feeling, it was equanimous, there was nothing there, I wasn't aware of the five senses. Yeah, you were asleep. No, I wasn't asleep. I was awake. And she kept pestering him. Until, you know, I heard Ajahn Tate just say, ugh. Just basically to get rid of her. But the result of that was she came out and said, he's confirmed it. I had a fourth jhana. She wanted it so badly. She was going to ask him until the end of the week, until he said something which he could sort of twist, ugh. And that's when I first, you know, it's not what you attain, it's not what you use, you know, to prove just how great a meditator you are. Now this is things which are just so peaceful, so still, you're not proud of it, because pride has got nothing to do with it. Your ego, your sense of self is disappearing, so it's not something you want or wish for. It's just what happens when you start to disappear, and your sense of self starts to fragment and disappear and vanish. That was the first one. But the other one which happened was I had all of these important questions for him. So it was my turn to come in. Even as a monk, you had to make an appointment and wait a long time. And you only had one chance of 5 minutes. Not like over here you have many interviews and you can come and make another interview or whatever. This was one chance and that was it. And when I came in, I saw this little monk looking over the Mekong River, so peaceful and so kind. And then when he looked at me, no questions left. All those questions which I thought about, my one chance to ask these questions, they vanished completely. And I just sat there, just like some dummy, without any questions. And the thought came in my mind that they're going to get about 10 water buffalo with chains to pull me out of here. I'm not going anywhere. Because one of the first times in my life, you felt this beautiful wisdom, unconditional love. He wasn't going to ask anything of me, wasn't going to criticize me, wasn't going to point out all my faults. He wasn't trying to cure me. Just perfect care. That's why I didn't want to move. I realized that all those problems, trying to find solutions, they trying to cure your doubts, trying to get wise, that's not what the path is. The amount of wisdom you can accumulate. Oh, just professors can do much. They know more than I know, as far as wisdom and suttas and stuff. But what he knew was just how to make peace and totally accept. And with that acceptance, I didn't need to achieve anything. I didn't need to be anyone. I didn't need to be enlightened. All that being, craving, striving, just vanished. And you felt so peaceful, so joyful. Like what I mentioned earlier about imagining what it's like to be a Buddha under a Bodhi tree. Here you've just been bathed by an arahat. It was such a wonderful experience. And somebody gave me a simile afterwards. And it's the best way I can describe this. It's a simile of people with invisible spikes. Everyone has got spikes coming out of them. You can't see them, but you feel them sometimes. You get a bit too close, you go, you know, past their comfort zone, and you get scratched. You know, you say something, you know, take a snide remark or something, and you feel really uncomfortable. Some people have got such long spikes. And they're so sharp. Even in the same room, you feel uncomfortable. You feel scratched by them. They're just really nasty people to be with. Most people have got their average spikes. You know, you can say hello, good morning, share a cup of coffee, but you get too close to them, and they sort of scratch you. And there are some people, you know, even they can be members of your family. You've grown up with a brother or sister. You go too past their boundaries, and then you get scratched. And there are some people with very tiny spikes. You can just be so close to them, and they look after you, and you can abuse them sometimes, or abuse their kindness, but you get too close, get out of here. You get scratched. But there are some beings who've got no spikes at all. No spikes, and just you feel 100% safe. They won't harm you at all. They'll only care for you. They'll never criticize you, never give you an emotional violence by asking you to do things which you can't do. A total acceptance. And I don't know how else to describe it, but you felt like you didn't need to improve. All my life I thought that I wasn't good enough. I could always improve. I can always do better. I can always find a new joke. But there he was saying, yeah, you can find a new joke, fine. You don't find a new joke. You're still accepted. You're still a good friend. Thank you so much. I never needed to improve or get better. And that was from that experience, so peaceful. Enlightenment is not trying to become a better person, believe it or not. It's being at peace with yourself. And then you automatically are a better person. So many of the anger, the violence, the mistakes, the hurt we give to other people or to ourselves is because we're not at peace with ourselves. Trying so hard to save the world that we destroy it. Being so kind to be a good husband, you just give such a terrible life to your wife. Just being you. Being at peace with yourself. And then, you're the best husband, the best wife, the best monk, the best nun the world can ever have. The trees and the forest simile, which I haven't mentioned yet. Here we go. Never mind. Trees and the forest simile. That I gave a simile at Mental Health Week in sort of the Perth Convention Centre a few years ago to people who, this weren't the counsellors, it wasn't the psychiatrists, these were actually the clients, the people who had disabilities, who had autism, Asperger's, who had schizophrenia, who had all these other stuff which the mental health industry were trying to treat and cure. So I get up there. I'm not a doctor. I've got no degrees. I'm not from a university. And so this one woman, please excuse the language here, she came up to me afterwards to apologize for how she thought when I first walked into the room. And she said, who is, please excuse, this is an English word, it's not a nice word, who is this wanker coming in to teach us? It's a very bad word. If you don't know it, you've lived a very good life. It's very English. Ryan. So I told them, one of the first stories I told them was the story of the tree in the forest. That you go and have a walk in a forest and find a perfect tree. A tree which has got no damage on the trunk. A tree with all of the branches equally spaced, with no branches which are twisted or broken. With trees, with all of the twigs having leaves on them, and there's no leaves which are being eaten by bugs, or which are dying, or which are spotted, or which are brown. The perfect tree. We have a forest here. Can you find one? They just don't exist. Maybe in your imagination. Find a perfect person. Do they exist? Find a perfect monk who always answers the questions on an evening instead of leaving most of them. Who always remembers to do the chanting at the right time tomorrow morning at 5:50 instead of forgetting. A perfect nun who is always wise and compassionate. These things don't exist. But, now find a beautiful tree. And then you find the most, your favourite tree, the one you always want to hang out with. That beautiful tree will be all bent and twisted and have damage on the bark and on the trunk, where maybe another tree has hit it falling down, where the storms have ripped off branches and left these holes in the trunk where the animals and the birds live. And the branches all this way and that way, with some of the leaves brown and yellow. And when you look at that tree, that's the most beautiful tree. The twisted, the bent, those which are damaged. So I told this maybe 150 people who were the clients of the mental health system. I said, first of all, if you are not perfect, if you are damaged, bent and crooked, first of all, you belong. You're a tree in the forest, and you belong in that forest. And number two, more importantly, you may think that no one likes you, but it's the bent and the twisted trees, the damaged goods, which are the most beautiful trees in the forest, the ones which I like to go and visit and sit under. Sat up crying. They were accepted. They didn't need to change. They were beautiful as they were. And so this idea of trying to become a, get rid of their schizophrenia, get rid of their Asperger's, to try and fit in to the perfect human being, to get cured. No! You belong as you are. And because you're imperfect, you're damaged, you're one of my favourite trees. And I met that, and they got it, which was wonderful. So, that, why did we get onto that one? Oh yeah, agitate the acceptance. And because they didn't need to change, they were cured. They're at peace and happy with themselves, they fat in. They had a space, a place in the world. That's how it works. I thought those things were agitate. There I was, stupid, young, arrogant English monk, and there he was, just totally accepted me. I fat in. This amazing stuff there. It's not trying to improve. Okay, you're in Thailand, now this is the way you should act when you're in Thailand. You're a monk, you should never let your robe fall down. You should always be upright and upstanding, and never mention such words as wankers. Get in big trouble there. So this, you get the point here? Just you are you, be you. That's why there's many of the arahats in the time of the Buddha, people didn't know who they were. They didn't stand out, you didn't like have like the sign of an arahat. Some of the ordinary people, sometimes ordinary monks, sometimes young monks, young nuns. There they were, going around. No one knew that they were at the end of samsara. They couldn't tell, because they didn't look like the agitate, the perfect, the archetypal. If you imagine like the arahat, the perfect monk, the enlightened beings, do you imagine them as fat? I don't go there. How to develop or redevelop and regenerate loving kindness, especially after repeated experience of people disappointing you with selfish acts. I refuse to let other people stop me being kind. Don't care what they do. I do care what they do, but I'm not going to allow their bad behaviour to stop me generating loving kindness. Why should you allow other people's behaviour to control you? You never did bad karma. They did it. Their fault. So what they do, it's none of my business. I decide to have loving kindness. It's my choice, and that's a choice which I take. Be stubborn. Don't other people just control your happiness. So, they do selfish acts. Oh, that's their problem. But I will never react. The same as think, oh, just you poor things, you're doing selfish acts, bad karma's going to come like that. Oh, what are you that for? You don't get angry, but sometimes you have some sympathy, some compassion for them. During morning talk, you mentioned using the power of imagination to let people have an experienced taste of nimitta during meditation. If one has not experienced nimitta before, there is no prior knowledge to base on to imagine. Would this distort the perception of expectation of nimitta such that one would not know, realize one sees, experiences a real nimitta? Of course it doesn't. Especially you're experiencing peace. And I've described nimittas enough, and many of you've heard some other stuff, so you get it imagining. Real nimittas is so many different types of nimittas. And one of the weirdest nimittas which I ever experienced is in my cave, which apparently you're going to see on Friday. And I was sitting there peaceful, really nice and peaceful, and a nimitta came up. And I know it's a nimitta because the sounds and the body's disappearing, getting a lot of joy, and mind's very clear. And one of the real signs it's a nimitta, you're seeing colours which don't exist in the real world. Blues which are deeper blue than anything you can paint. Like a pure colour, rich and deep. And the colour I saw was yellow. Really clear, pure, intenseful yellow. No painter could ever paint that. But it was on a shape. And there was black lines on the shape. And I recognised it. It was Garfield the cat. The Garfield nimitta, that's very rare. I've been reading too many comics. And of course, I never said, no, Garfield, what's that? I never, my speech was really not there, but laughter just burst out. I just burst out into laughing. And of course, that broke the nimitta. And it also broke the samadhi, so I had to open my mouth and hold my tummy when I laughed at seeing the Garfield nimitta. Has anyone seen the Garfield nimitta? Really rare. It's true. Not, you can't make up these stories. But what I knew is a nimitta. It was very peaceful. I just basically blew that meditation. But the colour was just so intense. That's on it. That was an imitator. You know, if I'd have not laughed, I'd have just gone to, you know, just one of the sections of Garfield's body and just gone right into it. And just allowed the imitator, the beautiful yellow, to dominate. But I didn't do that. During one of your deep meditation sessions, you were able to go back 2,500 years ago to see the Buddha. Oh. What questions will you ask the Buddha? Could you please share with us? I would ask him. Contentment. No desires. So, anyway, if I did ask him, oh no, maybe I should be able to, could be able to do that. Because I know enough Pali. If I ask him in English, or you ask him in Hokkien, you know, you wouldn't understand a word you're saying. Well, maybe you would because of psychic powers. I don't know. Anyway, if you have no questions to ask the Buddha, what statement or reports you are going to tell to the Buddha of our present time? It's just good enough. I don't know what... It's a weird question, that. Never got that question before. If you were able to go back 25 to see the Buddha. Actually, it's very... Let's go back. That means you were a disciple of the Buddha. You were in their presence. But imagine most of the disciples of the Buddha, if you're that close to such a powerful enlightened being, you actually just were in their presence. Most of those would be enlightened by now. Certainly they wouldn't have any questions because they get that transmission of just like... Almost like a transmission from Ajahn Tate. Wordless, just the kindness, the peace, the emptiness, the freedom. Nothing there, so nothing to ask. Can you repeat what are the five basic fetters? Yes, I can do that. Can you please lead up the imagination of a Buddha at 6 a.m. every morning? Thank you. Yes, I can do that. Not that I will. You want me to do that? 6 a.m. every morning, you want this? But what about when you're back in Singapore? Everyone. Well, anyway, the five basic fetters, that is, what is it, the view of a permanent essence, of a soul if you like, they view that you can become enlightened just both through some rites and rituals. The view that you, the doubt, skeptical doubt, instead of just suspending doubt, getting information and then analyzing. And the lust, desire, and also, basically lobha and dosa, ill will and wanting. Those are the five basic fetters. And the imagination of the Buddha at 6 a.m. Was that recorded? That imagination of the Buddha today?
Yes.
Yeah, so if it's recorded, this is actually, now being serious, if there are some guided meditations, such as that imagination of the Buddha, which work for you, get a copy of it. I mean, it should be available somewhere. Yeah, with Scotty over the back there, or somebody. And then load it on your machines, and then with your earbuds, and then play it. Any time, not just 6 a.m., but any time. So any time you really want to try that out, you know, even on the aircraft back home, you can put that in there and listen to it. And then it's just like, you know, you have the monk or the nun sitting right next to you, and you hear it, and it takes you into some deep meditation. But other times you don't need to do that. So that's how it works. So I understand that Venerable Chanda, she's not going to the toilet. She's going to the, oh wait, I thought you were going to the UK. That's not a toilet. So have a safe trip and I'll see you in a few days. Very good. Sada sada. Bye bye. Okay. I have an auntie who was a devout Buddhist and a strict vegetarian. She used to do lots of chanting when she was alive. She passed away 2 years ago from stomach cancer. I remember seeing her on the hospital bed, suffering from extreme pain. One day before she passed away, a strange thing happened. The hospital room that usually smells of alcohol turns this very unpleasant smell. A few hours before her death, questions. Do people near to death always give very unpleasant smells? What causes this unpleasant smell? Do cancer patients always die from excruciating pains? Thank you. No, they don't always die from excruciating pains. Sometimes, just before a person passes away, this is what's called terminal lucidity, which is a very interesting, powerful concept, which I first read about in a book by Leo Tolstoy, who described in some dasha somewhere in the Tsarist Russia. There was a family in there, sort of patriarch, their father, grandfather, was dying painfully, and the family were trying everything to try and take the pain away. But it was 24 hours screaming and moaning, and he was describing just what happened to a family and how it just was driving them bonkers, trying to find something to help their loved one, but the loved one 24/7 moaning and groaning in pain, trying every possible therapy, from allopathy, homeopathy, everything except psychopathy. That's a joke, by the way. Didn't get that one. Anyway, that, and then suddenly he went quiet. All this moaning and really screams for days, and described suddenly there was silence. But he hadn't died. He had these moments of lucidity, clarity, with no pain, for many minutes, and then he passed away. He said this was quite common in the days before drugs, but even now with drugs, with pain numbing drugs, you know, the opioids or what's it, the morphine, even then people with morphine in coma. They're dulled out, but the last few moments, they have this clarity, this terminal lucidity. And it's so common. I was in a conference over in, oh, were you there? It was in Singapore, in the Renshen Hospital, of like end of life, death, dying. And I asked the people who are in palliative care, looking after end of life treatments, how many of you have experienced terminal lucidity in your patients? And a lot of them put their hands up, doctors and nurses. And even one of the doctors over in Perth, when I gave a talk about this, he said, came up and said, yeah, my story. That I was one of my patients that, you know, dying is a process. And you can actually start to actually see the start of the dying process and just actually know exactly what's going to happen next. So the dying process started in one of the patients earlier than he expected. So he rushed to the bedside, realized that, you know, gone past the point of no return. It was dying. And proceeded, opened the bedside drawer and took the phone directory, the mobile phone directory, of the relations. And was ringing them one by one. Come to the hospital now. You know, your father's dying. Now. And the next one. And then got to one of the patient's daughters, Julie. And said, Julie, you know, this is the doctor. Your father's dying. Come straight away. And then the patient, who was, you know, in coma, opened his eyes and said, tell Julie how much I love her. And then the patient died, passed away. And Doug said that was impossible. He was in coma, drugged to the eyeballs, and it was clear for just a minute. And there's many beautiful times like that. What is happening, as far as I understand it, the brain is now dysfunctional. The brain, through the dying process, can no longer function. And basically, it gets out of the way in your mind. So it takes over and just can run this body just for a few seconds, sometimes minutes, and can just allow you to say things and speak. When a person should be in coma, should be dead. One of the ones which I read was in a Time magazine, a feature on mind. I always was almost kicking myself, I never kept a copy of this. But it was a classic case of terminal lucidity of a gentleman in a New York hospital who had brain tumour. And the brain tumour was basically colonising all the cells in his brain. And it was going at a steady rate, and so the doctor could actually predict, you know, what was happening and when. So he didn't need to call the patient's family. He said, look, sometime tomorrow, you know, the brain is taken off over all the last important parts, you know, of the control the body. So you better come now. So they're at the bedside, just waiting the last few hours of the patient's life, as the tumor was just taking over the last parts of the brain. And the doctor said what he saw was impossible, but he saw it, with the brain totally taken over by the cancer. The patient opened his eyes, bent up, and talked to everyone in the family for about 15 minutes, telling, you know, all what they wanted and all these beautiful things about what he wanted to do and how much he loved and appreciated them. 15 minutes of clarity when the brain was dysfunctional. And after saying that, he closed his eyes and died right there. No brain happening. But clear mind. And it's such a common experience these days. The medical profession is giving it a name, terminal lucidity. And that's what happens when. So, yeah, sometimes you may be in pain. And if you are in pain these days, as a Buddhist, please take the morphine, the painkillers. Because sometimes, as a Buddhist, people say, well, it means that, you know, I'm not going to be mindful when I die. You will be mindful when you die. Those last moments, long periods, short periods, you'll be free from the fog of the painkillers, of the opioids, of the morphine. You have your terminal lucidity. And you won't be tired and exhausted by battling with that terrible, terrible pain for sometimes days. You'll be free. And at that time, that's when you can recollect or do that last minute business. Be peaceful and have a good death. So, check out terminal lucidity, what happens. And the room smells of alcohol, or it is some stomach cancer, it may be just the rotting of the flesh or whatever, I'm not quite sure what causes the smell, but not every person who dies has a bad smell. So, that is just strange. It's really, usually the hospital would have probably just, you know, just have some sort of things to make it smell better. But it may be very, very strong decay of the flesh of the stomach. I'm not sure. Can you confirm that to become a Sotapanna one does not need first jhana? I can't confirm that. To me, you know, I can't see how you can break through and to see non-self without one of the jhanas. However, you can be on the path to being a stream winner. Because I had some of these people who, for example, there was when Devadatta wanted to take over Buddhism and he got the king Ajatasattu to help out. They wanted to assassinate the Buddha. And so they had this plan. They'd hire an assassin. And they hired the assassin to kill the Buddha. And then to cover their tracks, they hired two other assassins to kill the first assassin. Four assassins to kill the second assassin. Eight assassins to kill the four. 16 to kill the eight. And 32 to kill the 16. That way, covering their tracks. And so what happened? The first assassin went with a knife to kill the Buddha. Couldn't do it. The Buddha was such a beautiful being. And it's like my recollection of Ajahn Tate. You just can't harm these people. They're just too... You know, it's like clubbing a baby seal is hard enough, but a Buddha... Oh, you're just too nice, too soft, too much loving kindness. I just can't bring myself to do it. And so, you know, the man confessed that he came here to kill the Buddha. I'm sorry, and asked forgiveness. And the Buddha just forgave him, obviously. And I gave him some teachings. And that man became a stream winner. Right there, an assassin with such a bad mind. No jhanas, no mindfulness, no satipatthana, no precepts, no right sort of conduct at all. He was an assassin. And the Buddha said, there's another two people coming to get you, so don't go this way, go another way. And then the other two came. Have you seen any of this assassin? He said, look, I know what you're up to. He's gone another way. Don't follow him because, you know, it's bad karma. And he was so kind, he even made his two other assassins became Buddhists and become stream winners and go for refuge. And this happened to all of them, even the 32. And they all said they became stream winners. No jhanas, no Eightfold Path. How could that happen? Well, what it means in the suttas, the thing about on the path to being a stream winner, once you've gone the path to being a stream winner, it's going to happen even by the end of your life. You cannot stop it. So because it's certain in this very life, this is the other thing which I got from the Vinaya. If something is certain, it's like it's happened. And the easiest equivalent to understand what I mean is that if you've really upset the triads, or you've upset the mafia, and they say, Claire, you're a dead woman. And you're like, no, come on, you just, because you know, I know you. So you're not dead. But he said, what do you mean, I'm alive? But your death is certain. That's why the mafia boss, you're dead. It means the death is certain. We use that idiom, sort of in English, and that same idiom is in Nepali. You're a stream winner. I'm not a stream winner, but your stream winning is certain. So you're as if a stream winner. And that explains so much. It means by the end of your life, you'll be a stream winner. What about the jhanas? Do you need a first jhana to get the fruit of stream winning? What happens at the end of your life? What happens is the five senses stop at your death and you see this beautiful light and you go towards that light and you know what to do with it. In other words, if you don't see a nimitta in this retreat, you will see a nimitta when you die. Five senses stopping, tantamount to the jhanas. Why are the five aggregates suffering? In Pali it is known as Panchupadana Kanda Dukkha, literally clinging to the five aggregates. And they say, is the clinging the same as the five aggregates? Is it separate from the five aggregates? It means that the fuel in the car is part of the car. Is the petrol engine, is that part of the car? Is it separate from the car? It's part of it. So the five khandhas now, especially the sankhara, you know, the will, that of now pushes, or rather rolls, the process of khandhas to the next form of khandhas. And the next form, the fuel, the gas, is in the khandhas. It's not apart from it. That's why they say, it's not clinging to the five aggregates is dukkha. The five aggregates are dukkha. That's what it says. Dear Ajahn, I'm currently reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. If it's the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, just go to the section on living. Is that, do they have, I haven't read it, is that part one and part two of living and then dying, or is it all both? What's it? Sorry, it's both. Okay, now I know who asked the question. When I Google the author, it appears, oh yeah, there has been alleged to have violated a few of his female followers. He has indeed. And even, I don't mind saying, Venerable Metaji. You know, he was in that group for a little while, saw what was happening and tried to complain. And he was just ignored. It's a big problem. And the trouble is that sometimes somebody asks this, is it bad karma to criticize a monk or a nun for misbehavior? Of course it isn't. Please criticize it, because otherwise you are neglecting to care for and protect Buddhism. If people say it's bad for you to criticize monks or nuns, who says that anyway? Bad monks and bad nuns say that. Protect themselves. In the time of the Buddha, all those rules called the Vinaya, the Patimokkha rules, they all came because men and women saw the monks and nuns doing bad things and said, you know, to the Buddha, please, I saw this monk, saw this nun doing something. And even if it wasn't like a really bad thing, people could think it's a bad thing. Can you please say something about this? And that's where all the rules of Vinaya came from you. Good men and women who weren't doing this to destroy the Sangha or to destroy monks and nuns, were doing it to protect monks and nuns. So that's, you know, why it's good to do that. So otherwise you get these things happen because people wouldn't criticize. It meant that, you know, it became a scandal. But he actually wasn't a monk. He was in Tibetan Buddhism. Sometimes people get a bit confused. What is a monk? What is not a monk? Of the same order of monks or nuns or monastics or whatever, lamas, whatever. So that was one of the places I used to go when I was a lay Buddhist, to this monastery Sami Ling in Scotland. It's the only place where, you know, it was Buddhist, you can meditate. And what made me sort of lose my faith in there. The monk there, it was Akong Rinpoche. And, you know, when I went there, he was in his robes, really impressive. But then at 5 p.m, he knocked off work, changed from his robes into a suit, went into his mini car, and drove from Estelmuir to Dunfermline, where he lived with his wife. He was a 9-to-5 monk. And that, you know, something even then, I thought, something wrong about that. You're either a monk or an ancien, or you're not. So anyway, so it was confusing for people, but it was, you know, if Sogyal had a wife, that would be acceptable, because that was allowable in that tradition. But it was actually sexual exploitation. That was the problem. Now, using your position of power to basically coerce sexual favors, like a cult leader. And that can destroy sort of the Dharma Buddhism. It should never happen. Even years, I think when I first went to Singapore, that Eileen's sister Angie, she asked me to, you know, some person.
Cousin.
Sorry?
Cousin.
Cousin, sorry, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you go around together so much, I think your sisters, but cousins, okay, thank you. They're taking me to the airport to get a flight, I think it was to London, from Singapore, and she said, can you please, you know, talk to this woman? And the woman was asking me, is it okay, you know, if your lama insists you have sex with him as part of your duty as a disciple? And Angie knew what my answer would be, but this woman would not believe Angie, but would believe, like me, as a monk. Reasonable one. I said, it's wrong, it's terrible, you should never do that. You're being exploited. It's got nothing to do with Buddhism. The Buddha would never permit that. That was an offence. You should not do that. So I made it so sort of quite clear, as everybody would know, but this woman had to hear it from a monk. Because she heard that you should do that from the Scadiwag monk, who's her teacher. That destroys Buddhism. And it's not just Theravada, Zen. You ask the Dalai Lama, he'd say the same. So please, you know, don't get sucked in. Because especially in Chinese traditions, you know, you venerate teachers. And it's almost like a teacher, a monk teacher, can't do anything wrong. You may not understand what he's doing or what she's doing, but it must be right. Please use your common sense. Anyway, supposedly highly evolved beings. No. You know if they're evolved, not by what they say, but how they behave. Now that's why I had so much faith in Ajahn Chah. And that one of my best memories of Ajahn Chah was when he asked me to go and get something from his room. The first time I'd been to his private quarters. I went out to his room. He almost cried. In that room, there was nothing. It was just a grass mat bed, a wooden pillow. I think there was one robe on the wall, on a bamboo sort of railing. And that was it. And this monk, Ajahn Chah, he was going to visit the queen in Thailand, the king, famous generals, multi-millionaires. In his monastery, it was nothing. So that's a monk. Keeps nothing for himself and keeps his simplicity, even though he's hobnobbing with some of the wealthiest people. And that really inspired me. So have a look in the quarters of the monks you support. See what they've got in there. Cool. Do you believe in a mission calling from above? What's your thought? I believe in people saying, I believe in the mission calling from the clock saying I've only got 10 minutes to go. Also, a person who had died was called back because he/she has not completed certain responsibility. Is this real? Is one of these stories, and you can check it out because this was told to me by Nibuto, the monk. He's over the road there. There's the monk from the Punjab. I don't think he mind me, you know, asking if you want to ask him, was this true? Because in his village in the Punjab in India, there was apparently in that part of India, most of the men have the surname is actually Singh, and all of the women have the surname Kaur. And so it's only a matter of time, you know, when you get not just the same surname, but similar first names. So, it was this old lady, I think one of his aunties or cousins or something, in the morning she died. And, you know, it was, you know, Punjab is not a backward place. The doctor came, looked at her, checked her out, pronounced she was dead. So according to that tradition, they had to arrange the funeral that day, so they got the cremation, all the wood together, and the coffin, and some priests or whatever, and just... But then, before they did the cremation, in the afternoon, she woke up, she came to. She wasn't dead, and that really surprised everybody. Good doctors had got it wrong, she actually lived. But then, she described what had happened. She said, when I died in the morning, she said, these two little devas, beings, spirits, that's what I was looking for, two spirits grabbed her and dragged her away from the village to this big spirit, like some boss, some leader. And as soon as this big spirit saw the two, minor spirits dragging this woman, the big spirit scolded them. You brought the wrong Mrs. Kaur. Take her back. So they had to take her back, and they took her back, and that's when she woke up. She was fine. And a few minutes later, another Mrs. Kaur passed away. This time they got the right one. Similar first names. So, because of that, I tell, people here and overseas that if I die, don't burn me yet, because I might come to and they take Ajahn Brahmali. It's very close. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahmali. Don't get names which are similar. Now, the first part of that was actually true. Can you send us a copy of your latest word of the Buddha, even though it's work in progress? Yes. When I was in Berkeley, just for that last global conference, I was talking with a Wisdom publication and the person who's taken over there from Daniel Aitken. And anyway, he said, no, we want to publish this. So, if I just give it out, then I say, we don't really want to publish this now. And it will get to more people. So just wait for a little while, and then you can actually be published. And I'd better promise this, because Venerable Chanda has been on at me and says, can the royalties go to Anukampa? Because they should never go to me. I said, yeah, why not? So, if you... And it's also, it gets further afield if we do, if we actually publish it, instead of just printing it off a feed distribution or putting it on the internet. So that's my grand plan. So that's why, be patient. It is coming. Sorry? Oh yeah, but they do that part. That's actually, the editing is just the formatting. And some of the diacriticals. But actually I will refuse to have the text edited so they change the words. Because that translation, they can really mess up what I'm not trying to do. I'm never going to say that's the end translation, but that's what I want published. And from there, people can actually get the idea of what we're doing. Don't think that one translation, because it's been there for so many years, or because it's done by some great scholar like Bhikkhu Bodhi or Yanaponika, never think we can't improve on that. Because sometimes, out of reverence, you know, we know something is wrong, but out of respect, we don't change it. And this is something which is important for people's understanding of the Eightfold Path and how to become enlightened. So that's why then, and English changes, the different languages change, and so, if, you know, little words, like when I was young, to have a happy day, you know, to be, they called it to be gay and carefree. But if I said that now, it'd have a totally different meaning. Language does change, and we have to, you know, change with it. And so that's why it's publishable, but it's never going to be the final definitive copy. I want people to keep on adding, improving to it. But there comes a time when I have to finish with it and just publish it. What is the difference? Okay, last question. Hey, I didn't do so bad today. So it's half. What is the difference in karma between young men, soldiers who fight in a war, versus old men who direct them to fight, even though the soldiers may be unwilling? It's... to tell someone to do something is almost about the same as doing it yourself. So even the generals, again, are in big trouble. At the second jhana, will has ceased. How has that shone a light with respect to Buddhism's stance on activism? Activism, this is... well, before the Buddha was about to become enlightened, Mara came up to him and said, you could be a wheel-turning monarch. You can create so much peace and harmony and prosperity, you know, in the world. So, you know, you be the leader. Activism, sometimes you see when people start sort of a project, start to do good. So have a very honest and good reasons. But then they turn, because they are still got their greed, hatred and delusion, they're still defiled. It turns to violence. One thing with activism, socialism, changed when I read Animal Farm as a kid. In Animal Farm by George Orwell, a very simple book, the animals were mistreated, so they took over the farm and drove the human beings away. And they had their credo, their dogma, and it started off with all animals are equal. And one by one they changed their rules. And with that first one, all animals are equal, they added later on the pigs took control, and they said, but some animals are more equal than others. That famous words were, because, you know, we are sort of deluded, goodwill turns to bad actions. We kill to save the world. We destroy to create peace. We have the war to end all wars. It doesn't do that. Vengeance to the tyrant fled, and caught the tyrant in his bed, and slew the wicked tyrant's head, and became a tyrant in his stead. That was from William Blake. And reading that and seeing history, be careful. Are you competent to be an activist? or are you going to turn into the monster you're trying to defeat? Despite having small democratic polities in the past, in a Buddhist India, why hasn't Buddhist societies in general, not the Sangha, maintain and preserve democratic states? Interestingly, despite the flaws in Judeo-Christian societies, certain tenets such as free will and love had helped and propagate free and democratic societies. Why is that so? Pope is not a democratic. It's an autocracy, let's say, patriarchy. Even in the Anglican Church, it's a patriarchy, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or even actually the head of state is the monarch of UK. So sometimes, how much of democracy has come from a church? It's almost like in spite of the church, there has been democracy. Have they really propagated, supported democratic states? The biggest democratic state in the world? India. It's not a Judeo-Christian religion. They have elections, and how they organize those is amazing. But anyway, I'm not a politician, but I remember the patron of this center here was Dr. Jeff Gallup. And he was a premier of Western Australia when he got depression. And he actually came here to get through his depression. And so that's where he became very friendly with me. And I almost had him as a Buddhist. And that was my big plan. Because this was not just an ordinary premier of Western Australia. Because Dr. Jeff Gallup was the best friend of a certain Tony Blair. Jeff Gallup was the best man at Tony Blair and Sherry Blair's wedding. They were in Oxford together. And so my plan was to get Jeff Gallup, he's still a good friend, best friend, and from him I could actually work on Tony Blair. And once you had the Prime Minister of England as a Buddhist, then you had free access to the White House and George Bush. And that way I was going to change the whole world. Really close, but when Jeff Gallup got depressed, he resigned. He resigned at the height of his power in West Australia. He was so respected. But he said, no, just the depression, just I can't carry on. And he was actually respected to this day. So that was my one shot at taking over the world. It was close, but never worked. But he did tell me this, the meaning of politics. He said politics is the acquisition, preservation, and the use of power. That's the purpose of it, to acquire power, to maintain it, and use it. And sometimes in the acquisition and maintenance, sometimes you do very bad things, because you think once you have power, you can use it for the good. Power corrupts, as everyone knows. Okay, there goes my political discourse for today. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.